time for Climate Thursday. We are joined in the studio by Timothy Johnson. He is a professor at Duke's Nicholas School of the Environment, and he is in studio with us today. Tim, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Andrew. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm glad you're here to talk about climate and sustainability, as we like to do as often as possible on News on the Hill. And I want to make sure I do it once a week. That's why we have Climate Thursday. And I wanted to start by talking about the work that you do for the Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke. And we were talking off mic beforehand. You said that your primary role is as an educator, as a teacher. So what's got you most excited about teaching in the Nicholas School right now?
Oh, my, where to start with that one? I need to hijack your mic and transmitter for the rest of the evening if you really wanted me to do that justice.
I like that.
What I think what it comes down to is this is probably the most exciting time to be teaching, you know, anything related to energy in probably the last 100-120 years. And I know if any of my students are listening, they're probably thinking, oh, there goes Tim again. But I mean it. It really is a terribly exciting time. I'm not going to predict how the future is going to play out, but we really are at a time of unprecedented transformation right now in the ways in which we supply and use energy.
And why is that exactly at this moment that things are so exciting?
A lot of it's driven by concern with climate, the need to reduce emissions. You know, globally, about 3/4 of, you know, greenhouse gas emissions are tied directly to energy supply and use.
And not to get too history wonk here, but how make the argument for me that this is a more transformative period than, say, the Industrial Revolution for the environment?
Oh, well, the Industrial Revolution. So I'm really thinking the last 100-120 years of the energy system. But, you know, we are seeing a lot of change. The last century or so has been marked by fairly incremental evolution. And you're at a point now where you're seeing new technologies, new resources, new markets, new business models. And with all that, new regulatory challenges, new policy needs, all that's coming together. Again, it's happening very quickly.
Our guest is Timothy Johnson from Duke's Nicholas School of the Environment, and we are talking environment and sustainability. And I have to admit, you sound, you've got a little optimistic tone in your voice as you talk about this sort of thing. And the last conversation that we had on Climate Thursday with Ashley Ward was kind of framed around that too, where she was saying from a policy standpoint, 2022 was the best year we've ever had for environment and sustainability. You're down there in the trenches teaching students at Duke, and I'm hearing that optimism coming in your voice too. Are you guardedly optimistic for the path that we are on compared to where we were, say, 10 years ago?
Oh, certainly. You know, the conventional wisdom about what's possible has changed dramatically in the last decade. There certainly are hurdles ahead. That's what makes it such an interesting field to work in. But I'm optimistic that a lot of that change is taking root and we'll maintain that momentum.
What do you see, kind of looking at this from the point of view of as an educator, what do you see as kind of the biggest area where we could advance ourselves, particularly when you talk about kind of that perception of what's possible? Where do we have the most to gain right now when we're looking at, you know, training the next generation of professionals who are going to be out in the world?
Well, I think one of the things that's so interesting about energy is it doesn't fit within a single discipline. I'm going to sound a little bit like an academic, but, you know, if you think about energy, you say, oh, that's maybe for engineers or maybe for the lawyers or geophysicists if you're drilling someplace. But really, everybody needs to be involved. I mean, there's a business component, a policy component, a legal component, of course, an engineering component. I had dinner several years ago with a person who made a fortune in the oil industry in Texas, and he looked at me very honestly and said, what energy needs are more cultural anthropologists. I thought, cultural anthropologists, you know, in energy. But he had a point to make, understanding behavior, understanding how we perceive risk. All that comes together. I mean, this is, again, what this transition is all about.
And it's one of those deals, too, where I have small children. So the last time we had a power outage, for example, you know, the kids keep asking to do things. You're like, no, we use power for that. That requires electricity. Like everything that they ask, no, we use energy for that. And to your point, that's the lifestyle we live in. Like everything consumes energy. The room that we're in right now for this radio station, there's an absurd amount of energy being consumed. So it kind of is like an ideological shift that has to occur. And it sounds to me like you feel like we are in the process of making that shift now.
We are. Again, that 3/4 of global greenhouse gas emissions are tied to energy. If you want to think about how to reduce that, well, where do you start? You try to start with efficiency. You try to start with conservation. And oftentimes, some of those measures will pay for themselves over the long run. So it's getting people to think long run, you know, as opposed to the short term, because they cost money. But the savings, you know, will pay themselves back over time. So there's that. You know, you go beyond that, then if you want to reduce emissions, you just try to electrify the heck out of everything, which kind of gets at your point about, you know, what happens when the power is not there. But it's transportation, it's buildings, as much of industry as you can. And if you want to do that, then you have to make sure that energy is as clean as possible. And that involves a whole lot. What enables that, you know, electrification, what enables renewables and other forms of low carbon power?
We're speaking with Timothy Johnson from Duke's Nicholas School of the Environment, and that kind of brings me around to the reason I originally reached out to you is we were kind of trying to deconstruct the Duke Energy plan for reducing their carbon emissions by 2030, and then the State Utilities Commission released a report that was offering sort of guidance on that, and we were hearing a lot of feedback from environmental groups about how much they were relying on fossil fuels for that, where they're still burning natural gas and creating some natural gas infrastructure. So how does that relate to what we're talking about here in general with this you know, kind of understanding of needing to electrify as many things as possible for the greatest payoff?
Oh, it relates directly. So 2 years ago, Governor Cooper and the General Assembly, and you know, rather bipartisan move, passed legislation that called for the state to reduce its power sector carbon emissions 70% by 2035 from 2005 levels. You got that? A little bit complicated, but let's just say it's a big reduction in a short amount of time. Duke Energy, through Duke Energy Progress and Duke Energy Carolina, supplies almost all the electricity we consume in the state. Therefore, the burden for that fell on Duke Energy. Last year, Duke put forward four different plans for how it may, you know, achieve those carbon reductions, not all of which hit the 2030 target, but they did within the terms of the legislation, which gave it a little bit of wiggle room. Those plans drew on things like expanded solar, more hydro, in particular pumped hydro, which is a way of storing energy as water, more battery storage, offshore wind, advanced nuclear power, as well as natural gas and further retirement of its coal fleet.
So, and looking at what your research and teaching topics are, the write-up on the website says, the intersection of energy system planning, design of the built environment, and natural resource management. So that to me sounds a lot like stuff that local government can actually impact. How much control do we have, say, in Chapel Hill about how our built environment and our management of natural resources, how much can we actually do about that locally?
Oh, a fair amount. It's limited at this, you know, this level of government. Transportation, though, emissions from transportation exceeded that from power generation in the U.S. about 5 years ago now, and that was big news. Not that power is easy to decarbonize, but it's actually much harder with transportation. If you think about how you go after transportation emissions, you can try to produce vehicles that are more efficient, that get better mileage, or you transition to other forms of energy, electric vehicles being a good example of that. That gets you so far. Beyond that, you really need to think about urban design and how, you know, the landscape, our built environment, influences our demand for mobility. That's where local governments have, you know, a lot of options that make sense given their jurisdiction.
In thinking about the intersection of all those areas and how it's all like one great system that, you know, uses energy and contributes to climate change, if you had some sort of a magic wand and could just kind of wave your hand and one thing changed that about the way we build our systems and the way we build our environment, what would that change be? What would be the most effective change that you could wave your hand and make happen be?
Oh my, if you're thinking about, again, you know, reducing emissions, there's really no one solution that would do it. You know, people talk a lot more about density. Density is a way of enabling walking, biking, other kind of lower zero carbon modes of travel, as well as, you know, access to public transit. That doesn't fit all lifestyles, though. You know, you can make a good argument that packing people close together doesn't always achieve the social outcomes you want. But certainly anything that would enable people to get out of their cars, and find other ways of commuting, would be a good start.
Our guest is Timothy Johnson from Duke's Nicholas School of the Environment. It is Climate Thursday, and we're talking climate and sustainability. And time flies. We actually only have about a minute left. Is there anything that you wanted to mention that we haven't gotten to yet?
Oh, I think I'll just return to the point I started at, which is just a really exciting time to be in this area. And if I sound optimistic, it's really excitement coming through, because we could talk for hours about the practical hurdles we need to get over. I don't want to be pessimistic, but if you were to stand in 2050 and say what would have to happen, to decarbonize, a lot has to happen. And, we'll see challenges ahead that are going to be significant road bumps.
Our guest has been Timothy Johnson, and this is Climate Thursday. Thank you so much for joining us, and I look forward to talking again sometime in the future.
Yeah, thank you for having me.